Hello, and welcome back to Vox Popcast, the weekly pseudo-academic roundtable of pop culture analysis with drinking and swearing. My name is Christopher Maverick, but you can call me Mav, and I am once again here with my co-host, Wayne Wise. Hey, Wayne, how's it going?
Hey, Mav, I'm all right.
Been a couple weeks.
Yeah.
It's weird. I always forget because since I'm here almost every week, it's like, oh, wait, who's been on last week? But yeah, we were doing like Oscar shows and stuff, which is not my
bailiwick. Yes. So
clearly you watched the Oscars yesterday, and wow, what a ceremony. That was crazy.
What a show. Amazing. There was that one thing that everybody's talking about, which so there's no point in us talking about it.
Yep. That's right. Because we certainly have recorded this since the Oscars, which were yesterday, if you're listening to the day this drops. But maybe we'll talk about those in the future, but not today, because we're really busy today. What are we doing today, Wayne?
Okay, so I blogged this, and I know not everybody sees the blog, but I recently accidentally saw The Beekeeper.
Yeah, it really was.
I work for a lawyer. He was having a rough week. There was a lot going on. Every once in a while something like this will happen. He called the office. He was on his way back from court, and he's just like, you know, we just need a break. Let's go see a movie. So he took me to a movie, and that's what was on at the time that we arrived at the theater.
Gotcha.
So I accidentally saw The Beekeeper.
Nothing to do with the box office game, because you do have that in the box office.
Yeah, I do. Well, yeah, the $20 he paid for our two afternoon tickets, you know, went toward my score with the box office game. So,
wonderful.
So thanks, Eric. And it was fine. You know, it was a movie. It was spoilers. It's John Wick, where Felicia Rashad plays the dog. And yeah, and I don't mean – there's nothing against Felicia Rashad, just in terms of the plot point she plays. And the movie I'd seen prior to that, and we've been talking about this on the show, was Godzilla Minus One. And somewhere in the middle of that movie, it hit me like, oh, this is kind of the same movie, except the giant monster of destruction is just this guy, you know?
Okay.
And it started making me think about all the other – guys like that who, you know, Liam Neeson, the Taken franchise, I think, you know, a man with a particular set of skills who just wades through his opponents unopposed, almost just so good at fighting and killing and doing stabby things. John Wick, I think, is the current best example of this. And, you know, like, we expect our superheroes, like, we expect, you know, Iron Man or whatever with powers to be able to do these kind of things. But I think there's something going on in movies and genres, and I think it's been going on for a long time. It's not new with this, of this one guy who is an unstoppable, violent force of nature if he is motivated to be such. I think there's something there to talk about.
Okay, so when you posted the blog, like, they tweet out when we post them to the blog. So it was immediately retweeted, actually really quickly after I posted it, after I had it set to post, by our friend Henry. Hey, Henry. Whose last name I'm not going to even pretend to pronounce, because Producer Beattie. Henry, as you're all called. Yeah, I know.
Oh, yeah, Producer Henry works.
So, which I know Henry from, you've been on the show before, but I know you from the YouTube show Wisecrack, which you are.
Yes, from Wisecrack Live, which I stream weekly over on the Wisecrack YouTube channel. But yeah, I've been on the show with director Lux. He's from Wisecrack as well, to talk about AI before. And the premise of the post really caught my interest. I do a lot of, I'm a bit of a film geek myself. I do a lot of editing and production work. I've written criticism in the past, although I kind of slowed down on that when I started doing production work. Yeah, I'm here to chat.
So, yeah, well, welcome to the show. And yeah, thanks for being interested. So we never know what we're going to get when we throw that stuff out there.
Yeah. Well, especially when we pick a weird one, right? Because this is not like a specific, I think we're going to have very academic thoughts on it, but it's not like there's people who study the human kaiju. In fact, when I was getting ready to do the show, my wife, Stephanie, who's been on the show, she said, what are you guys recording about tonight? It's like, oh, Wayne did a post about human kaiju and we're going to do that. And she goes, I've never heard that term before. And I'm like, that's because Wayne made it up last week. Yep. That's why.
Yep. That's exactly it. Yep. And it's because of the confluence of those two movies, you know?
Yeah, I have some questions about the kaiju aspect in particular. And what really stood out to me and why I responded so fast, I feel, is because I too accidentally saw The Beekeeper when I could not catch a screening of Poor Things.
Thank you for contributing to my box office game.
Yeah.
$40 bucks. Really, yeah.
What really struck me about it is, like, yes, it is very clearly within the John Wick clone kind of like archetype breed, but what it does in particular, I think, really gets to the kaiju aspects of what I think you're getting at when you use that for shorthand. And I'm kind of curious if you want to talk a bit about that before we get back to talking about the Beekeeper.
Yeah, I say it was really the confluence of those two movies and just my brain putting them together. I don't know that, kaiju is probably not the best way to describe this. It just kind of hit me that the similarity of this single figure wading through all opposition as an unstoppable force of nature.
Okay.
So, and that was really the extent of my thought on it. And I wasn't even sure I was going to call the blog that or whatever. Just when I texted this idea to our ongoing chat, just as, hey, I got an idea for an episode, I called it that sort of jokingly and tongue-in-cheek. Mm-hmm. And then as I was writing the blog, it's like, well, what can I call this? I'm like, yeah, well, okay, let's just go with that.
Yeah. What it sparked for me is in kaiju movies, as a fan of Godzilla and Ghidorah and all those Showa era ones, is just the way, like, it's pretty blunt what a kaiju stands for a lot of the time, metaphorically. Mm-hmm. They are a force for some sort of semiotic or symbolic power. Mm-hmm. And the Beekeeper, to me, was really fascinating because of all the John Wick movies, I can't think of another one where a character so often would stand up and talk about the rights of the elderly before just completely crushing the younger generations under his thumb.
Yeah, well, so when Henry texted me, like, you said, what did you call it? You were like John Wick, but as a defender of boomers or something.
He's going to defend the elderly from the phone scammers, and the phone scammers have their hands in every pie. They have their fingers in every pie. They are the scammer behind everything. The president's getting paid off by them. Everything's corrupt, and it's the people it's such a common, visible, especially among the elderly, problem. It swings in and goes off on these speeches about how conning the elderly is worse than conning children, to which he does make some pretty great speeches about that kind of stuff. And then he just unleashes his fury on people working in call centers, to which until that point, you're really with the movie. But I mean, I've seen HBO's telemarketers. I've worked in towns when I was younger where, like, I didn't have opportunities to use my degree, and, like, call centers were kind of like the place of last reprieve. Like, there's questions about who's the target of the anger in this narrative that I have.
Absolutely, yes. But I mean, there are people there who this is just their job. It might not be a great job,
I've not seen this one. So if this were a John Wick, right, when you'd go and you'd attack literally anything, whether it's a restaurant or a subway full of, like, homeless people.
Right. The dance club.
Right. Everyone in John Wick is also a, human kill machine. Like, literally everyone in that world is just a superpowered assassin. The way Henry's describing this, you're walking to a call center and there's just 25-year-olds just answering phones. They don't have guns. They're just
And there are places where he kind of gives them the option to get out. But there's a tremendous amount of just straight up collateral damage.
Wow.
So
they're literally the people that Godzilla steps on.
But yeah, right. And I think maybe, and I hadn't formulated it in quite that same way, Henry, but I think maybe that's why I had the kaiju thing of just Godzilla stepping on buildings full of call centers and 25-year-olds without a second thought. And that's kind of what Jason Statham does here.
Even the construction of it reminds me of, like, a cheaper monster movie, in the way that, like, he keeps setting places on fire every time he wrecks. There's always a scene after he leaves where, like, the police, your police subplot characters show up, and they're all standing in, like, a parking lot of, like, a burnt down office complex. But it's, it's the same setup throughout. Like, there are different, narratively they're at different locations, but practically you can tell, like, they had this, like, scheduled out to where, like, they can all shoot these scenes in the same lot in the same day and just, like, slightly move around the burnt objects in the background. It's one of those movies where, because of its, like, its weird, like, dents in the questions it raises, it really puts in context the genre it's representing.
And I think, I mentioned some others in the blog that fit in this category. So, Taken and John Wick, obviously. Mm-hmm. But the more I thought about it, it's not like this is brand new.
Right.
No, not at all. I actually don't think it is at all.
No, that's kind of what
I mean, do we have – so we were talking offline and I decided, well, wait, let's just talk about this on the air. The there's always been revenge movies, right? This goes right. back decades.
Death like, Wish comes to mind. Yes. Like when I first saw the Beekeeper, I was like, oh yeah, this is Death Wish.
Yes.
I would say every role that Eastwood played before he was 50. Mm. Like literally, I mean, be it a cowboy or a gangster or a cop, like this is just this was just Clint Eastwood's jam.
Gran Torino Eastwood thinks he's the Beekeeper.
Yeah, that's kind of what that's kind of what I'm getting at, right? So this isn't new. Mm-hmm. Then I'm wondering, in order for it to be a human kaiju movie, and just because I'm trying to set the parameters of this as a thought exercise. Are human kaiju movies allowed to be good? And I want to caveat that with the point that it's okay to say no, because if you've listened to the show before, I like a lot of what I'd say are technically bad movies. I would argue that John Wick is barely a movie, and it sure as hell is not four movies. Like I realize there are four things that technically qualify as motion pictures, but there is, you know, half an hour worth of plot.
Yeah.
The entire John Wick franchise.
There's no way I would say The Beekeeper is a good movie, but I found it cathartically entertaining for 2 hours.
Yes, that's exactly it. Now, but can a movie be good? Can a movie be – so you said Gran Torino, right? Mm-hmm. Gran Torino, I'd say, is actually – I mean, might not be everybody's favorite movie, but Gran Torino is a real movie. It's a movie, as we sometimes say on the show.
Right.
A movie you see in a theater movie. Kaiju.
Does Die Hard, John McClane?
Does Die Hard count?
No. And I'm thinking
Die Hard does it for me, but for different reasons. That's why I'm wondering.
And one of the reasons I don't think it does for me either, we see a tremendous amount of vulnerability in the character of John McClane in ways that we don't with John Wick and whatever. They set up that emotional vulnerability with him. Yeah. But
now by the end, I think Die Hard 5, I think Wrecking Ball. But like Die Hard 1, you know, he sucks too much. Like he is not good at being a kaiju. I think a better example is Rambo, right? Rambo in First Blood is a thinky, you know, anti-PTSD Vietnam movie. But like by Rambo 3, 4, 5, however many there have been, 82, you know, he is just a wrecking ball. So I think those are human kaiju movies, at least to me.
So I think when Wayne brings up the concept of vulnerability, it gets at something for me as far as what I classify as a human kaiju movie versus what I don't. And I just want to bring up in particular regards to John Wick, a quote from Jason Reed. This is a philosophy professor from the University of Southern Maine. But this is something he said in the past about John Wick. I'm just going to read it off. It's a tweet of his. He says, "I'm only half joking when I say that the decline of the training montage in contemporary martial arts films is related to the effacement of work and collectivity in contemporary society. John Wick emerges like a commodity, fully formed."
Interesting.
Yeah. And so he's talking about John Wick as a commodity, fully formed. And this is something that also comes up. There's another film writer, Danny Anderson, in Film Inquiry. He has an essay on John Wick as, you know, capitalism dressed in religious clothes. The short of what I take from his essay that I want to talk about here is the way he talks about, you know, coins and currency and death being like the currency used in the John Wick universe. To me, a human kaiju, like, is a monster. He's fundamentally detached from humanity in a way that, like, yeah, it lacks the emotional vulnerability of something like a Rambo or even, like, the Transporter, which is interesting to me because the Transporter inspired Michael Mann to do Collateral, which is kind of, you know, Tom Cruise is definitely kind of a sociopathic kaiju in that.
Yeah.
Okay, so I just want to point out that the article that you're referring to, which we will link in the show notes, the Danny Anderson that you're referring to, friend of the show, Danny Anderson, formerly of the Sectarian Review, former co-worker of mine. I used to work at the same university that he works at. So yeah,
Danny's been on the show several times.
I will text him later and let him know that.
Yeah, that's funny. Know,
someone
that's great.
Incidentally cited him. That's amazing. That's but yes,
I do have. To bring this all home, though, the vacuousness, like the loss of humanity, to me, that's why maybe John Wick is the best and maybe kind of like the example and the only one I would consider like an actual movie on an aesthetic level, because is a feature, not a flaw, as far as it being a showcase of like stunt work and like the intent when it was made is kind of like a passion project of like the Wachowski stuntmen. Thereafter, the insistence on like taking the lore seriously like really doesn't sit right with me. And again, something like The Beekeeper really puts it into perspective, where it's like, oh, it's the homemade like commodity dude you could buy. He's the bodyguard for like the boomers who are anxious about a withering like social security safety net. I feel like there's a purpose to the human kaiju, and it is kind of like that kind of gnarly like want to like have a monster in your control.
Yeah, so, and so we do a lot of shows with the monsters.
I'm wondering if some key movies that I think are in this genre that I really like and are of varying quality. I would say the first Taken movie is very good, but I think that all three Taken movies are this genre of film. They are human kaiju movies. Now, and you know, we used to say, we said on the show even, that like the Liam Neeson January movie is just a genre of film. Liam Neeson is an actor who now stars in Liam Neeson movies. That's what he that's what he does. Old man, particular set of skills. That's the
I think that speech kind of lays out the parameters really well.
And you know, I don't have money. It's like I have a particular set of skills. I would also say
there's a sort of like Gibson transactional
ability to Mel Gibson in Ransom. You know, you've kidnapped my son, I'm gonna get him back. That's the whole movie. You need to know nothing else. And now I'm gonna Mel Gibson everybody. You know, old, and by Mel Gibson, everybody, I mean the old Mel Gibson, which just, who just wrecks shit, not the older racist Mel Gibson that came later. He might have been racist, but we didn't know yet. And I think also I would say one of my favorite, or two and a half of my favorite movies are El Mariachi, Desperado, and more or less Once a Time in Mexico.
Yeah.
But they are literally just this. There's no plot. El Mariachi and Desperado literally have the same plot. They just changed.
Yeah.
Like, it's a sequel. There's nothing to it. It's just like a, you killed my woman and now I will kill everybody who, you know, did it, and the people they work for and the people they work for and the people they work for. And it's just a showcase of
you, death. You killed my fill in the blank, prepare to die.
Right. And I don't think Desperado or El Mariachi are good movies. They're not movies. There's no story. I think Taken is a good movie that I very much enjoy. So to me, much like I think that something can be a kaiju movie, whether it's, you know, Godzilla Minus One or whether it's the Matthew Broderick Godzilla, I think those are both kaiju movies, even though one of them is arguably much crappier than the others.
In terms of characters in other media, one of the examples for me, and there's been a movie and there's been an Amazon Prime series, is Jack Reacher. There's like 28 books in the series or whatever. And I mean, he's very much – I read something recently. It was a short e-book released by Lee Chow, the author, just describing his – the things that motivated him to create this character. And at the time – and this is early 90s, I think, first book came out – just how tired he was of flawed heroes. He wanted to create somebody who was just damn good at what they did. To crib a phrase from comics, the best there is at what he does. So he created Jack Reacher, who's 6'6" and 250 pounds of pure muscle with military training, who just wades through people. He's Marv from Sin City, was born to be a Viking in a society that doesn't allow him. And in the books, you know, part of what fascinates me about him as a character is Reacher himself is he's very much portrayed as the wandering gunslinger of classic Western kind of thing. He wanders the country on his own. He doesn't have a home, doesn't want to have a home. He just keeps finding himself in these situations. You know, he's Angela Lansbury. Every town he goes to, somebody dies in. But throughout the books, rarely does he find himself in a situation where even me as a reader feels like, oh, how's he going to get out of this? You know he is. You know, it's the superhero thing. You know they're going to win. It's the process of how he goes about it. Reacher, as he's written, is very much on the spectrum. That's never addressed overtly, but his interactions with people, the way he perceives the world, it's just baked into what the character is. But, you know, he is, and this gets into something I talked about in the blog that I think we should bring up, is the thematic paradigm, the idea of an outlaw hero and an official hero. In Reacher's past, he has been a military policeman. And a lot of the novels are set in that past. And in those, he's very much working as an official hero. The plot comes out of whatever he is investigating in his role as military policeman. In the later stuff, where he's just wandering the country, it's just every town he visits, there's something crazy going on, people dying, some conspiracy, and his own sense of morality and justice doesn't allow him to leave until he fixes this.
Is the 18.
Yeah, right, yeah. And so, but he, as such, he kind of embodies both the official hero as the military guy, but then the outlaw hero who just steps into things and takes care of it on his own. And I think there's something going on with that concept that we can talk about in relationship to all these characters. And even though I brought it up and wrote it in the blog, I'm going to throw a good description of that at you, Mav, because you do that more frequently than I do in class. Paradigm. Like, I can talk about it, but I think you are more used to talking about it than I am.
Yeah, it's a significant part of my dissertation. So Robert Ray is the guy's name who comes up with it, and he's talking about, for lack of a better term, this is a gross simplification, but he's talking about the hero from the Western and how that hero gets moved into sort of everything from Casablanca to The Godfather. The thematic paradigm covers a very particular style of hero. So it's a hero who is anti-hero elements, but most importantly, he has a very specific, strong sense of right and wrong. He has a, you know, it's the thing that you said with Reacher. He cannot leave until the mission is done. No one else can solve the problem other than him. That is very important to, there is a mandatory performative masculinity. Now, at this point, we should point out that part of the thematic paradigm of the Western presumes a masculine hero, but it need not be a male hero. Which is very particular. So up until this time, most of the examples of human kaiju we've talked about, in fact, I think all of the ones we've mentioned on air have been male characters, but very much you could have a female character that does this exactly. The very easiest, most explicit one I can think of is the Bride from Kill Bill. She is just this. Like, the Kill Bill is two movies where the plot of the movies is Uma Thurman will wreck shit in order to get her daughter back. That's it, right? And like, I mean, you the first one barely even has a reason. You know she wakes up and then she's gonna go kill people. Like, all the plot happens in movie two.
An interesting note too, especially Kill Bill Part One, is a huge influence on that movie is Snowblood, and that movie is very explicit in classifying its protagonist as a demon. Like, you know, she's Shura. Like, she's a Shura. She's a thin Buddhist, like, consumed by anger. Like, yeah, Lady Snowblood is a human kaiju from Japan.
So you're looking at characters who do this sort of thing. La Femme Nikita, another female character that does it. Atomic Blonde. Like Proud Mary, it's Taraji P. Henson. So there are a lot of films where this is the plot of either gender. But the entire point of the human kaiju, I think, if we're going to go from a thematic paradigm aspect, is we are talking about a world where plot is melted away, at least I think, in favor of just the performative, superpowered, undefeatable monster aspect of being an anti-hero. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so. And yeah, and the Reacher books do have a lot of plot in them, in addition to a lot
of violence. Taken has a lot of plot in it. But just not the key element of it.
Yeah, when Wayne was talking about Reacher, the word process came up, and that really strikes me as kind of key to this, is that the human kaiju, like, destroys the structure. They cut through the process. Whereas, like, I mean, even the best Superman stories aren't about how he punches through things. It's about, like, why a particular process is the most moral or ethical or reason to take.
Well, and I think, I mean, another part of it, you're talking about the thematic paradigm. I also mentioned the American monomyth thing. And I think this plays a part as well of, you have a, and this is a really brief, and Mav, feel free to jump in and elaborate. There's a community that's a society that's under threat from an outside force. And because they are civilized, they can't deal with this. So they have to bring in someone.
Yeah. All right. So I'll be specific then. I'll give you the specifics of Ray's version versus Jewett and Lawrence are the guys who do the American monomyth, which is what they call their version of it. So Ray says that the cowboy archetype, you know, a thematic paradigm. We always say the thematic paradigm because we're always talking about the same one. But the concept is that a thematic paradigm can set any genre. And he's talking about the cowboy hero. So in his case, there's a cowboy hero who has a propensity to whims, tantrums, and emotional decisions derived from America's cult of childhood. Ray says he has a distrust of civilization, typically represented by women in marriage and constituted as a stock motif in American mythology. And the outlaw mythology of the cowboy hero portrays the law and the sum of society's standards as a collective impersonal ideology imposed on the individual from without. Thus, the law represents the very thing that the mythology sought to avoid. So for Ray, the thematic paradigm of the outlaw hero is, you know, the sole individual walking against the wind, you know, basically
shame,
but for the greater good, for the greater good. Shane is a prime example here.
Yeah.
And you could also look at The Godfather, which is, you know, very much a bad guy character, but he still represents a cowboy outlaw from Ray's point of view. Okay. Like that is where starts getting weird.
Yeah.
Okay, so Jewett and Lawrence, who write several versions of this book, but they're basically called the American monomyth, they define the hero's journey differently than classically the monomyth is usually this term by a guy named Joseph Campbell, who has stages of a hero's journey and they repeat over and over again in a cyclical structure. Jude and Lawrence say that it need not be a cyclical structure. It's more about the individual aspects of the hero, who has three mythic patterns that define the American monomyth. The first is saga, which is to say it's unbounded, and that like the American hero can go on a continuous stage of multiple adventures. The second thing the hero has to do is sexual renunciation, which is what they mean is they call it sexual renunciation, but what they really mean is that the American hero can't settle down. He essentially has to be a loner. So they, in my opinion, they do a lot of work to try and make the idea of sexual renunciation work. And they have a whole section where they're trying to say, no, the very classic Lothario heroes, like say Captain Kirk, and even real life person Hugh Hefner, it's not about sex. It's actually sexual renunciation. Anyway, it's weird. But essentially what they're ultimately arguing is that the hero cannot achieve marital bliss. He can't, he cannot be domesticated.
Rejects home and hearth. Yeah.
And that I buy into loosely. Yeah, I think it's complicated because you do have married characters that like are looking for something else. There's a whole big thing lately where we're having all these stories about, you know, the guy who's secretly a hitman and hiding it from his entire family. Like that's like a thing that we're doing a lot. And then the third aspect of the third mythic pattern that they recognize is redemption, because they would argue that it's always a redemptive arc that the monomythic American hero goes through, and that it's supposed to, the story is ultimately supposed to be sort of a metaphor, an allegory for, you know, the American exceptionalism story that, you know, we will find redemption for our sins through the usage of this one hero. Where I think maybe the kaiju thing is going, if you want to go the Jewett and Lawrence way or the Ray way, is I think that we are forgoing the idea of redemption. It doesn't matter. Sexual renunciation is automatic because it's not part of the story. We are only talking about the saga. We are only dealing with the anti-hero aspect and turning it up to 11 in order to interesting.
I think part of that, my understanding of that monomyth, just that core repeating story is that, see, there is a community that is under a threat, a civilized community, that because they're a civilized community, don't have the skills to deal with this outside violent threat. So they bring in the lone gunslinger, is not part of their community, but he has the violent skills. He takes care of the big bad. He's redeemed by being a hero of this town. But he can never actually live there. He rides off into the sunset because now that he has fixed the problem, if he stays, he will be the problem. Mm-hmm. So I see some of that, and I think this is certainly part of their work, is that dynamic tension in America of, and I mentioned this in the blog, that we are united, the United States, e pluribus unum, we are a community, and that's the goal, but we are also rugged individualist who can fix all of our problems ourselves through our own acts and strengths and intelligence and that sort of thing. And those two things at odds and playing off of each other in these narratives.
Yeah. The idea of redemption, I would argue, is absent in a lot of these more like human kaiju movies. There's only the potential for losing what you already had, and you're not really like transforming or gaining any sort of wider scope or idea, or even, I mean, even on an aesthetic level, like the movies very much are what they are. They're not exploratory. Mm-hmm. They're conservative.
Yeah, I mean, Reacher is certainly not looking for redemption of any kind. He sees his actions as completely justified under the circumstances.
Nor is Wick, right? Wick even just...
Right,
I mean, Wick just kind of looking for revenge,
from what I recall.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that revenge narrative as well. There, I remember years ago, and this ties into the comic stuff that Mav and I do, talking to a number of friends, primarily some female friends who are writers, and just how turned off they were by the ongoing cliche trope of let's kill the hero's wife / girlfriend to give him a reason to go out and do these things. And yes, it's the women in refrigerators issues in comics. And that's absolutely a trope. And I'm thinking, John Wick avoids that narrowly, but not really. Like, his wife dies of natural causes, but she gets him a puppy because he needs something to love. And then the bad guys kill the puppy, and then he goes on a revenge streak. So it's not the death of the wife, but it kind of is by proxy.
Yeah.
And ultimately ridiculous, right?
Yeah, right. And the beekeeper, it's this, Felicia Rashad kills herself because she's been scammed. You commit suicide because she's been scammed. And she's the nice old lady who is the only person to ever been nice to Jason Statham. Therefore, let me burn down the White House.
Yeah. I think an example we haven't brought up yet that maybe a bit like even grimmer than the beekeeper to me, as far as like what it's saying with its ultimate point, is nobody, which I find nobody pretty viscerally enjoyable. Like, people share that bus scene a lot, but just the point of the movie is he's protecting his retirement account. It's one of the most absurd and kind of like bizarre things to me.
And the fact it's Bob Odenkirk, who, the Better Call Saul and stand-up comedian and all that stuff, the casting of that was kind of a brilliant take on that concept, because he's not the person you think of as a man with a particular set of skills.
So neither is Liam Neeson, or at least he wasn't when he did that first one, right? Like, he's sort of carved out this niche for himself as, hey, now Grandpa can be an action hero. Because he's Liam Neeson. But with the first Taken, I think I would argue that a big point of the first Taken is you're not supposed to suspect him, right? You're supposed to think, what is this old guy going to do? And also, the first Taken, it's been like, what year has that come out? That I think it's been well over. I don't think it's been 20 years yet, but what year did Taken come out?
That's the first thing I saw Maggie Grayson post Lost. So
15 years. It's been 15, almost 16 years since Taken 1 came out. So he's only gotten older, right? And I think that there's that, like, that is an aspect of it.
But I recall when the Taken trailer first dropped in a theater, like, I didn't see it on the internet first. I caught theater first. Like, it felt like that was the punchline. Hey, look at like, Liam Neeson's going to turn to the camera and give this serious speech, and like, he's going to kick a whole lot of ass. Like, that, the novelty was there before the rest came along.
So, but I mean, compare that to like John Wick. You look at him and you're like, oh, this is serious. This guy's going to kill some people. I mean, even Jason Statham, right? Like, Jason Statham, nothing about Jason Statham says that he's going to lose ever. Like, that's the entire point of everything from Transporter to Beekeeper. and to, you know, Hobbs and Shaw. Like, that's just the movie that he makes, right? The character that Jason Statham plays is, I am the guy who will get results. Like, yeah, like I look like a guy who can shoot people.
Hyper-real competency porn.
Yeah, so I do. Well, so there's another one. Henry, yeah, we were talking about just a little bit offline. The Crank series, which I adore. Speaking of bad movies, there are two Crank movies, Crank 1 and Crank 2. And I have no notes. Everything. I mean, my note for either of them is there needs to be a Crank 3. They are not good.
Earlier I was talking about like John Wick maybe my favorite in the genre because it's like aesthetically like the most harmonious, but Crank 2 might outclass it in that respect. Like it's swinging harder.
And what really makes it is Crank 2 has a scene where they actually turn into kaiju for no apparent reason. There's just a scene for one fight scene of the movie. They grow to be 50 feet tall and they wreck buildings and tear down power lines. And they are clearly men in rubber suits. And then they go back to being regular men again. And it's not explained. It's not part of the story. It's not like they're not Kamen Rider. They don't have magical powers. It's just like there was a narrative. There was a directorial choice made that for aesthetic reasons, for this fight and this fight only, these men are going to be monsters.
Yeah, it's interesting too to think of that movie not as like it's not a parody of these movies because it came prior to them. It's like a weird aesthetic genre, just like embrace of the absurd.
It's just a postmodern moment that just gets dumped into the middle of Crank 2. So I take it you've never seen it, Wayne.
No, I don't know if I've ever heard of this.
Okay, so Crank 1, the premise of Crank 1, and this is why I think this is actually a really interesting way of avoiding the women in refrigerators trope, though not at all avoiding the male gaze trope. So Amy Smart is the female lead, and I use that term very loosely, of the Crank series. She is a character who exists for Jason Statham's character to have sex with. That is what she is there for. She is hot because the actress is hot, and that's her part. And as I understand it, the actress actually enjoys it. She enjoys the ridiculousness of what they are. But in the first film, the premise is Jason Statham, who is a professional hitman, wakes up one day and he's not feeling well. And there's a videotape where a guy who's one of his enemies explains on the videotape that while you were sleeping, we injected you with a poison and you are going to die in an hour. Or whatever, you know, in some relatively short amount of time. And then so he calls his friend, the doctor, and the friend's like, oh, shit, you've been poisoned with that. Well, what you need to do is, you know, it will be slowed down if you keep your adrenaline high. So whatever you do, just, you know, start running, start doing whatever you can to keep your heart rate up. And that will keep you from dying for a while.
So it's the movie Speed, only with a human instead of a bus.
He is the bus and Speed. And then he goes on this terror trying to kill everyone who injected him with this poison without letting his heart rate drop down and trying to keep himself as adrenaline up as possible so that he can kill everybody before he dies. That's the plot of the film. And then he dies in the final scene. But it's a surprise hit. So they make a sequel where it turned out he didn't die because it just so happens that they didn't know it, but his heart was invulnerable. So,
the second one is a cartoon.
Yeah, it might as well be. Yeah. And so in the second one, his heart was invulnerable. So he turned out to be okay. But then when he was in the hospital, because he had fallen out of a helicopter in the end of the first movie. Yeah, it's that kind of movie. So in the second one, while he was in the hospital, someone stole his heart. So now he's got a artificial heart inside, but the batteries are running out. So he has to keep injecting himself with electricity. I mean, it's basically so it becomes a game where he is essentially in a platformer video game.
Yeah.
And it is a game where he runs to the right and kills people and tries to like not let his health bar get too low.
Like a live wire to his chest just to like get a jump and then has to like hop onto the next car, move on to the level.
Yep. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and then for one scene, he becomes a kaiju. So, you know, because that happens.
That's great.
So that's, I don't know. I recommend everybody see this movie because it does have the direct, you know, here's guys as kaiju scene. But like, I don't like,
can they be good?
Because I don't think Die Hard counts. Die Hard doesn't count because the movie, not because the movie's good, but because he's too vulnerable throughout. Like, he is not a wrecking ball in the first Die Hard movie. Mm-hmm. He is a flawed individual who I think is just likely to die at any given moment. So he, I don't think, can be a kaiju. Because you don't believe that he's going to make it through. Like, he might die just from glass on the ground, right? Like, he's not doing all right. So, but I think in the later films, maybe. But I'm trying to think. Yeah, I think Taken counts, though. So Taken is, mm-hmm. and I think Taken is a good movie.
Well, how about things like the Jason Bourne movies?
Mm.
And he's definitely vulnerable.
Yeah, and I haven't seen most of them, so I don't have a good, and it's been so long since I saw the first one. I don't have the memory. My memory of John Wick, and I did just watch the first one again recently, but my memory of it was just, it was 2 hours of him beating people up. And that's not my impression of at least the first Bourne movie, that there was more to it than that.
Oh, most
definitely. Yeah, there's a lot of plot, actually. There's a lot of plot in all the Bourne movies, even the one he's not in.
The first one especially is pretty much paced at him more like running than like actively engaging in. I think like many kaiju movies.
In fact, a lot of it's him trying to avoid conflict in the first
Bourne. Okay.
I think I think many kaiju movies, I've seen a lot of these, and I enjoy like the genre, that, like what it channels and what kind of conversation it's really in. Like, I like talking about the art, but I wouldn't call it like good art or like necessarily like I like a lot of these movies, but if I had to top 10 list of a top tier movie thing, I don't think there'd be any showing as far as
they'd be good or not. Well, and just I'm trying to think, just going back through the history of film and books as well. I mean, film, because of what we're talking about, film seems to be the most obvious place to talk about these things. But and Mav, edit this out if we've already talked. I forget what we talked about when we started reading. But the Death Wish movies in the 70s, Charles Bronson, I mean, because I think they're definitely examples of this. I think there might have been more plot and not as much choreographed action. But the plot of
I think those count because he does have, you know, he is on a revenge cycle, but mm-hmm. like mostly it's a lot of, you know, like, I mean, how many are there? There's got to be three or four.
I think there's four or five.
Yeah.
Wow. And it really is just him. Like, I mentioned all the Clint Eastwood ones too, like, you know, all the Dirty Harry movies. But like, I think the Death Wish movies, the Dirty Harry movies, I think all of those are. Death Wish especially, it's how can Bronson kill people? And like, if you've gone back and watched them, they're not, from a 2024 point of view where you have John Wick movies, they're not terribly interesting kills. There's a lot of frankly black people running away from him and him shooting them at a distance. Like, it's a lot of, it's not great.
Well, there was a genre of books at the time, and as a teen I read way too many of these, but it was the Executioner, you know, who was the inspiration for the Punisher. There's got to be 573 books in this series written by Matt Bowen.
So without exaggerating, I believe there are over 200. There are legit over 200 books in the series. The guy passed on the legacy to other ghostwriters. It's a Nancy Drew, Hardy Boys kind of situation.
It was written by his name was Mac Bolan, and it eventually became a committee of writing it. But yeah, it is overtly the influence for the Punisher. This guy had a war wagon. He had the same origin. His family was, he was a Vietnam vet. His family was killed by the mob. I'm going to go kill them. And he spends 200 books doing so. But at that time, that was a genre in books. There was a series called
according to Wikipedia, as of December 2020, when the series ended, there were 464 separate novels.
Wow, holy shit. But I read at the time there was a series called The Death Merchant, which he was a CIA operative. There was a series called The Butcher, who was an ex-mafia hitman. And if you look at the covers of the paperbacks from the 1970s, The Butcher was Charles Bronson. So, and I don't know if the series came before Death Wish or Death Wish came after. I would have to look that up. But so there were Western books. I mean, there's, you know, the classic Zane Grey Westerns or whatever, but there were Western series at that time as well. One called Edge. Josiah Hedges went by the name Edge. And they were just, horribly violent and sexist, and I was reading them when I was 14 years old. But it was the same type of thing. It was that type of character. And there were just a proliferation of them in the 70s as series of there were 50, 60, 70 Edge books.
I was going to say Death Wish and Dirty Harry are interesting to me, too, as pieces of like film genre evolution. Both kind of more reactionary leans on Bullitt, which in the late 60s is...
Oh, yeah.
More like in the, it's not a human kaiju movie. It's not really a human kaiju. Like that movie's, I recently rewatched it and like it stresses so hard how kind of like sociopathic and dehumanizing the job is for McQueen in a way that like it's not romantic or sexy in the way that Dirty Harry Death Wish made the job look sexy.
All right. So in order to be a human kaiju movie or book or, you know, a story, does the job have to be positive, sexy? So, because I'm thinking about like Godzilla and other kaiju movies. Mm. Sometimes Godzilla is the good guy. Sometimes Godzilla is the bad guy, right? Like, the kaiju is a force of nature and it doesn't matter whether it's on our side or not. It's still the same film. All the human kaiju movies I can think of stars an action hero and we are supposed to think of him as, you know, as the hero, even when he's explicitly a bad guy, right? Like even when you have a character like Jason Statham, he is a bad dude in Crank. He is a hitman. He is murdering people, but we are positioned to like him for this story because he is being unjustly killed. So does the kaiju have to be the protagonist?
I don't know about protagonist, but I think like it doesn't have to be successful, but I think the authorial intent to sell you on like wanting the monster, making the monster appeal as far as like, yes, I want to hire John Wick to yes, the beekeeper is cool and I would love to use his service grievance. I don't think these movies always sell that the best way. I actually don't like that I used the word sexy earlier, considering how much of it is substituting the gun for the sex impulse. But yeah, I think there has to be like, because if the movie is like, even if I think the movie has to try to appeal to you, because if it's telling you it's wrong, it's trying to like do something deconstructive, or it might just be a horror movie in that case, if it's making the guy too scary or it's being like too introspective.
That's a good point. Okay, so there, okay, counterpoint, is Michael Myers a human kaiju or is he just the bad guy in a horror movie? Because he's unstoppable. I mean, he ultimately gets stopped a lot. But like the premise of not the original, and I'm not talking about good Halloween movies. I'm not talking about the original Halloween. Yeah. I'm saying in Halloween Part 87 or Friday the 13th Part 87 or whatever, right? Like Jason or Michael Myers or whatever is a slow lumbering force of nature that runs at the girl and kills everybody in her way, in his way, trying to get to the final girl, and she escapes at the last moment. And like that's a whole different genre, but are they effectively human kaiju? And it's just that when the human kaiju is a bad guy, that becomes a slasher film, and therefore like is the aspect of human kaiju, it's a slasher film where we're on the slasher side.
Say I'm gonna keep slasher and human kaiju kind of distinct, because I think human kaiju, it's a monster, but they'll fight for you, and I don't know, there's aspects of like ownership modification that horror movies don't have.
Yeah, and I think John Wick and any of these ones we've been talking about, however violent, they are motivated by something that has, I'm not going to use the word purity, but they're motivated by some genuine,
at least it's an ethos.
They're motivated by human responses, whether it's the need for revenge or justice or whatever. It's motivated by human standards, whereas
there's an understandable altruism, even if it's not our acceptable moral code. You get how somebody might like, you know,
if you're not buying it, there's an attempt to sell.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas they murdered his wife. I understand is the.
Right. Whereas Michael Myers and Jason or whatever is like, I'm going to kill a bunch of people because that's cool.
Okay. So, and you're right, because now I'm trying to think, are there any movies where the protagonist is killing people because it's cool without a rationalization? Because now I'm thinking about it, and the human kaiju, even in the dumbest of these movies, like, In John Wick, he's at least trying to revenge the dog, right? Like, there is always something.
Yeah, there's some motivating factor that has its base in humanity.
And so do we, and is that just, is that, I mean, that exists so that he doesn't seem like a monster to us, but is that the aspect of the human kaiju? Like, okay, like, all right, I can accept that Liam Neeson is going to murder all these people. They have his daughter. What is he to do? Like, you can't, you know, you cannot think about the fact that they're, you know, we can't think about the fact that, hey, maybe these guys are just working for, you know, the bad guys because they have families to feed of their own. And, you know, they're suspending justice
in the world. That whole thing, it's the stormtrooper phenomenon of, like, those guys all had families. You know, I mean, anybody on the Death Star, that whole idea of, you know, like the cannon fodder, you know, whoever is the collateral damage in are just there. And Grant Morrison in The Invisibles did a great take on this. There was, and I forget issue numbers because I haven't reread this in years, but there was an issue that showed the core team, the Invisibles, like breaking into this facility and you're rooting for them and they're doing stuff and they're killing people and they achieve their mission or whatever. And like eight issues later, he does an entire issue on one of the guys who was working there that day. And see it from his point of view. And he's a family man. He's trying to feed his family. And suddenly these radicals break in and start shooting all his friends.
Well, it's the theme of I Am Legend if you have the good ending, right? I Am Legend is Will Smith is out there trying to avenge humanity and kill all the vampires. But from the vampire's point of view, we're just trying to live our lives, man. Like, there's this monster who's murdering all of us. We don't know, you know.
Yeah.
But there you go. Is I Am Legend a kaiju movie or does it – I think it becomes a little too complicated by the fact that he's the bad guy there. I mean, you might think – like I think maybe it sets you up to think you're watching a human kaiju movie and then what makes I Am Legend work is you go, he's bad. Like he's like the monster.
Again, it brings up that introspective, like internal aspect that I kind of knocks it from being within the genre.
So now I'm wondering, and you know, genre studies are always weird. We've talked about that before. You know, you can never settle it, like what's in and out of a genre. But like I think we're at least getting to a concept. I do want to talk a little of what it can and can't be, though. I do want to talk a little bit about, you know, we had some comments on the blog, one from friend of the show, Marone Langsner, who just, you know, in pimping his own work, which is fine because I've actually used Marone's work. We had a whole episode talking about Marone's concept of the impossible body, and you know, go back and listen to that episode where we're talking about the specifics of why people like the spectacle of violence. But more over than that, do we need the human kaiju to be a practitioner of the impossible body? Does he need to be a nice superhuman force? So like, I think he does, because I think that what stops Bruce Willis from being this in the first Die Hard is that he's too vulnerable. Like, I think in order to be a kaiju, he has to be like, I think Batman counts, right? Like Batman can stomp people to where you're like, oh my God, that man's a wrecking ball. Reacher counts. John Wick counts. The Atomic Blonde counts, you know, La Femme Nikita, even though she's vulnerable, like, I feel like she's deadly enough. The Bride, you know, the Bride comes out with a bunch of scratches and stuff, as does Rambo. But I think these people all count because they are, you know, because they are beyond the pale of, you know, a squishy, very vulnerable human being. Like, I think the flaw of John McClane in the first Die Hard movie is you literally spend the entire movie thinking this dude is toast at any moment. And I think that the kaiju movie needs to not have that. So I think there's an aspect of embracing the spectacle of violence, the impossible body, the nigh superhero-ness of, but not superhero. Like, I think if you're an actual superhero, so that's why Batman's on the line for me.
And I agree. There is sort of this, I mean, going into it, I mean, particularly after you've seen one of these and you know this is what you're into, there is this aspect of invulnerability to the character. And not in a superhero sense, but just like, you know, they're coming out of this. They may have some scratches, a bloody nose, a bullet wound or whatever, but they're going to walk into a room of 30 people with machine guns and walk out of it. Mm-hmm. You kind of know that going into it. And the joy of watching it is the choreography of how they walk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the later John Wick sequels, I'm not a fan of, but the people that I do know who are big on them have told me it's mostly in a sense that he's doing a lot. They're doing a lot of Buster Keaton-esque performance and Looney Tunes on a more violent scale. And like, I can see where people come from when they appreciate it.
Okay, and that just made me think of Jackie Chan. You know, so much of that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the Buster Keaton type fight scenes. And his played for more for fun and laughs in lots of ways.
Huh. Yeah, I've been watching some Sui Hark Hong Kong actioners. And yeah, now it has me thinking about just like, again, the body possible movements.
I'm not sure I count Jackie Chan.
I don't either.
He's weirdly too vulnerable. I do count like to go a kung fu movie that I think, you know, maybe people have seen. Old Boy, I think, is a human kaiju movie.
Okay.
Because it's like he is enough of a wrecking ball to where I feel like even though there are stakes, you know, there are stakes on a John Wick level. Whereas I think for the most part, Jackie Chan's stakes are on, I think what separates Jackie Chan from Bruce Lee, to talk about two of the most famous people in that genre, is Bruce Lee is, you know, a guy running through a video game and you expect him to win at any moment. And Jackie Chan is a guy running through it and you expect him to nearly die constantly. Like you're looking for Jackie Chan to just barely scrape by, as opposed to looking for him to wreck people the way you are with a John Wick.
Also, like Jackie Chan movies, he'll be in situations he didn't ask for, in the sense of like he's not hired to do the job that he's like carrying out. It's defensive or like a reaction.
Yeah.
Often running away, just trying to be left alone.
I
think he's a little different. Yeah. Because I don't think I need the revenge plot, but I think I need. Oh, OK. So here's an interesting one. I don't think the Fast and Furious movies count. They're too much superheroes. As big a fan as I am of that.
Yeah. Fast and the Furious always felt like a live action, just like comic that relied on like an ensemble cast. Like it's an ensemble comic.
And their powers are too inhuman. They're to make them interesting in this respect compared to, you know, like anything that The Rock has starred in that's not in this line, right? Like when The Rock is doing something like the a skyscraper movie or whatever, you know, those are movies where I feel like he is like I think his character wants to be in a John Wick style movie when he's in a Fast and Furious movie, but the world of Fast and Furious, I think, is too impossible for it to count. I need a groundedness in realism, even though that character is just that side of exceptional, right? Like he needs to be.
He's never like the narrative setting that permits him to act the full human kaiju experience.
Yes,
the focus of the movie is more about the cars or the disaster or
personal.
So it's a line, you know, as we said, genre studies are always hard, right? Because you always have exceptions. So I don't think that counts. Now I'm just trying to, like, how do you define this? I was recently talking with somebody about how to define a Red Notice movie, because we're in a world where Red Notices are just becoming a genre, and like the ensemble. So, you know, to give an example, I would argue that Ocean's 11's movies, everything in that franchise is a Red Notice. It might be better than the actual Red Notice movie as far as how it's written, but it's a Red Notice. Those movies exist so that a bunch of friends can go on a vacation together and play themselves in a buddy movie.
Yeah, the Sandler gang as well.
Yeah, yeah. So
I'm just sitting here now hoping to cash in on fame and fortune for having coined the term human kaiju as it makes its way out into the pop culture universe.
PCA this year, but like I think you have a potential PCA topic next year. I mean, you've never presented at PCA outside of the comics group, right?
No.
I think you have a legit potential, you know, thing that you're ready to bring to the world with the concept of the human kaiju. Like I guess we've resolved nothing, but I think you do have a place that you can like work to bring scholarship here. This is an interesting concept.
Lots of avenues now visible to walk down.
Yeah. You're welcome, academia.
So anyway, yeah, if you have thoughts and you've listened to this episode, please let us know in the comments. You know, what are some good films that we've left out or that we've, you know, we've missed, we've, or that you feel we got wrong? You know, what should count? So, for example, Erin Childs left a comment and she said, does The Crow fit in here? She says, I feel like it does, but I don't know if he's too superhero supernatural. I tend to think most of the of these is vengeance, possibly justice driven, which I think is an important aspect. And yeah, I don't know. Does The Crow fit? Like, he is kind of supernaturally, but he's less supernaturally than I think the Fast and Furious gang is, which is
odd. Within the narrative of it being natural and magical does kind of rob it of the same kind of expectations for unrealistic or in execution. Like, yeah. Oh yeah, he's magic, he can do it. That's a bit different. Like, whoa, this guy's the top kill field. The real.
oh my God, that stand-up comedian Bob Odenkirk has all these skills.
Yeah.
And it's, he's right on the line, though, right? Like, for me, yeah. Like, because I'm wondering, like, to the extent that you're doing the bride thing from Kill Bill, right?
Yeah.
Like, she's not magic, but she's just this side of that, right? Like, she's trained in ancient art so great, that she is.
I think the point, the Punisher is, even though he exists in a superhero milieu, he is this.
The Punisher is exactly this. Like, he is definitionally just, you know, I'm going to keep killing and as long as I can. There is no end in sight. Like, he has a narrative reason, but he is this. Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas I think Batman isn't I think he's more superhero.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Bringing up that line of like superhero is human. Josh Crank's Chronicle, very much, you know, a movie about a teenager being a mom. And I mean, the found footage angles, the approach to how he's framed is like a natural disaster is esque. Mm-hmm. How do people feel about classifying that?
See, Chronicle, they're so superpowered, though. I mean, they're explicitly superpowered.
Yeah.
And it makes it, but it's a weird line, right? Because, because I don't know that
I find Chronicle interesting because we've been, you know, talking about boundaries and definitions and terms and what qualifies, what doesn't. And Chronicle, you know, it's supernatural, superhero based, but like on a visceral level, like violating definitions, it feels right to call it a human kind of way it conveys a character turning into a monster, at least to me.
Yeah, it's definitely lineish.
Because he's not John Wick being hired to do anything. Carrie Horror Story.
In our actual Kaiju episode 2 or 3 weeks ago, we talked about, you know, some of the superhero stuff and, you know, the Hulk just being, he's essentially a slightly shorter Kaiju, you know, and was born out of that same time. He is a irradiated, thank you, monster, you know, who just, you know, beats things up and destroys things. And, you know, appeared in comics right on the heels of lots of giant monster stuff.
Mm-hmm. So there are lines. So, you know, please let us know in the comments what should our limits be, because that's where I'm trying to figure out. I think this might be something we revisit in the future, though, because like they're not going to stop making these movies, right? Like,
No.
I mean, I think Liam Neeson is sort of like he's trying to move past it slowly as he just realizes, you know, the premise of these was that I'm too old for this shit, but now... You know, he's like,
I'm actually too old for this shit.
Yeah, I mean, he's 71, and I think he's like really, really feeling it now. He's just like, I started making these when I was like 50 and or whatever he was, 55, I think. And he was just like, this is enough. Enough's enough. So I don't know. I do want to know what you think the themes are, what you think the tropes that define the genre of the human kaiju are, so that I can trick Wayne into writing a paper. So I have to make
that's my You've already secure. Done that. I owe you a paper now. Yeah. You
have to trick me into writing something. I know. But anyway, Henry, thank you for joining us. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah, wonderful discussion. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it's always great when, like, literally, you know, we just post and then immediately someone's like, I have thoughts. And I'm like,
I wrote this blog like yesterday, you know?
as we record, it was literally like we were like, oh, we should do this sometime. And Wayne's like, because you've been like sort of mulling over it.
Thinking about it. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you see that beekeeper, and it's like, oh yeah, I still have thoughts on that.
So
yes. Thank you. What else is going to come up? Yeah, it's been months now. What's the beekeeper going to be? Where else can I discuss the beekeeper?
Like, you, I mean, you have your own show, and I don't believe you ever talked about it on there, have
no.
you?
No.
It's like, because, like, what? It's like, well, so again, just temping another one of our episodes. When we did our episode, which Wayne didn't, you didn't bother to show up, we did our episode on MILF Manor, which, you know, because Michael, who's on Henry's show, like, he had mentioned it on Wisecrack Live, and Monica and I separately started watching it. We could not, we have five co-hosts for this show. We started watching it and could not convince any of you to even look at it. Like, literally, everybody else was like, I don't want to even try. And Monica and I just watched every, we were like riveted. We watched every single episode. So right. Monica's like, well, how do we do an episode on this if we can't, you know, if we can't get anybody else to watch it with us? And then I just go, know a guy. I know. Yeah. And that's how Michael ended up on the show. Like, I text Michael and I was like, we want to do an episode of Vox Pop on MILF Manor. Want to be on? And Michael says, that's the easiest question I've had all day. So literally, it's a show that nobody, that we knew no one would watch. And it's just like, yeah. But, you know.
I find it funny. One of the reasons I didn't bring up the beekeeper on the show is because I saw it like 2 weeks late after it came out. So it wasn't really relevant, but it was in the same way that Wayne had mentioned at the beginning of the show, a movie that I saw because I didn't get to see my first choice movie at the theater. And so, yeah, it's interesting. Like, as sure as like a slasher movie or a horror kaiju range movie you'd comfortably go to if there's nothing else around.
Yeah. So, okay, and I've not seen it. So, do you guys recommend it? Should I go see The Beekeeper?
If you like John Wick.
Yeah, if any of the context we've clued you in as far as like what's going on thematically and just like aesthetically, if you're interested by like what we've said about it, I'd say go check out the whole.
Yep, if you're an angry boomer who has been scammed on the telephone,
yeah,
maybe the best movie ever.
I definitely think it should be watched in companion with the telemarketer. Yeah, HBO Doc series, just so you can kind of understand how.
Well, just for reference, it's made like four times its budget. And it's like, and it's got like a 70-something% on Rotten Tomatoes. So there's going to be more. Like one would assume that there's going to be a sequel, which is just amazing, which is, you know, success story for the thing.
Yeah. And so my Mav, this is a spoiler. It ends very open to sequels.
Wonderful, I guess. Anyway, Henry, once again, thank you for joining us. Where can people find you? I mean, you've mentioned it already, but you know.
You can find me at HisBelBeatty on Twitter. That'll be tagged when you share this. Mm-hmm. Right now, I'm working for Wisecrack doing the show weekly. You can hear me there. And you can check out my Letterboxd, which I can. It's just my name, Henry Aaron Beatty. But that's where I keep my critical muscle going when I'm doing action stuff. Like, every time there's a movie, just write a few sentences.
See, she's not on this episode, but literally ever since Twitter went bad, Monica, our co-host, has been going, follow me on Letterboxd. Come on. I'm gonna, and no one cares.
Yeah, it's not a very high traffic. It's more of a diary than like a social media site. But like I share thoughts there. Sometimes people comment and I've had some conversations with friends. But it's definitely not a spot where I've really like met new people. Just kind of curated and carried on existing relationships.
Fair enough. Wayne, what about you?
Yeah, here. You can find me here.
Yeah,
a couple times a month you can find me here.
Yeah, we've got some ideas like coming up. I know we're, you know, you were talking about one that I don't know if I'm even going to be on. I guess I'll probably be on it. There was a show that you and my wife are planning. So, you know,
some
interesting content coming up. So
nice.
Anyway, as always, you can follow me on the Twitter as long as it. I mean, I guess like it's becoming hard, y'all. It's like as hard as Twitter's been lately, it's just been really.
Yeah, at and this point, even if you're trying to engage the site, it doesn't want you using it. It feels like.
Yeah, it's becoming like it actively is trying to like dare me to quit. Like and this is real truth. Like I have an account on Truth Social. I don't use it. I have one because I feel like, you know, as a cultural theorist, as a professional,
you can check in on what's going on.
Want to know what's going on everywhere. I will, like, realistically, I do believe that in the current world, Truth Social is a more usable site than Twitter. It's gotten that bad. Truth Social is not great, and I don't recommend anybody else like create an account for it. It's garbage. All it is conversations about how great Trump is. That's all there's there. But it like, but if you're looking for something, you can find it. It's, you know, it doesn't force you to follow people that you don't want to follow. Twitter's a hellscape. It's just, it's awful. But I'm there, and I'm on Instagram and Facebook and Blue Sky and Threads, all the places. Always at Chris Maverick. You can follow the show. We need to fix this, but right now on Facebook, Twitter, and Blue Sky, we are at Vox Popcast. You can follow the show's blog at www.voxpopcast.com, where we talk about whatever we're going to be talking about next week. And you can leave us comments on this show or any other episode. You can suggest topics that sometimes we pick. Sometimes we pick guests from the blogs.
Yeah, you can comment and be a guest like the next day.
I'm living proof of that. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it works out really well.
We had fun.
Yeah. If you enjoy the show, we certainly hope you do, then please subscribe to us on iTunes or Spotify or Pandora or wherever the hell you get podcasts from. And do us a favor, leave us a 5-star review. If you leave us a 5-star review, not just a rating, especially on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, that really helps us out. It gooses the algorithm, makes us more popular, makes me feel all warm and fuzzy inside. I would like to thank Maximilian of Thoughtform Music for our epic theme song, Building Ever So More Epically, and playing us out. I'd once again like to thank Henry for joining us. I'd like to thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.